Oops the Podcast, Grady Booch. The Oopsla Podcast brings you up to speed on topics covered at this year's Oopsla Conference, which takes place in October 2008 in Nashville, Tennessee. For more information, visit the conference website at oopsla.org. The Oopsla Podcast is co-produced by Software Engineering Radio and Dim Sum Thinking. I'm Daniel Steinberg, your host for this episode. We talked to Grady Booch, Chief Scientist for Software Engineering at IBM Research and an IBM Fellow. This year's invited keynote speaker at Oopsla is an Egyptologist, and the germ for this idea came from Booch's Oopsla address a couple years ago on software archaeology.
About 10 years or so ago, I found myself increasingly being involved as a software architect and a mentor for architectural teams. What that meant is I would go in and work with organizations, generally working with some fairly large distributed systems, just to help them get their arms around some of the most significant design decisions that they were making. Most of the systems that I was involved with were not systems that were greenfield, but rather were systems that were transformations of existing systems and additions in various ways. And that required an effort simply to understand what it was that they had in the as-built case. So many of these organizations that have made an economic stake in the ground, that they've been successful, have grown rapidly from their software base, and yet many of them wake up one day and say, oh my gosh, we have this millstone around our neck called our body of software, and it's in a place where we can't blow it up anymore and start over, so we have to transform it. And that led me into realizing a lot of what I ended up doing with these teams was simply software archaeology. Let's take a look at the as-built systems, understand where the major fault lines in it are and the major design decisions that went into them so that we can meaningfully transform them because we can't blow them up. One of the realities that I learned from that experience, having done this several dozen times, is that every system has an architecture, although most of them are accidental and only a few of them are really intentional. And most of that architectural information lives in tribal memory. So whereas the code is the truth, it's not necessarily the whole truth, because there are decisions that one can't discern just by gleaning the code itself, especially as you move to really large systems.
Every project has that you need to go talk to so-and-so to see why we do it that way.
Yes, that's the tribal memory issue. And it becomes particularly challenging in larger organizations that are older, wherein those folks that own the tribal memory, the intellectual property, they're moving on. Especially among some governmental agencies I've worked with, they've lamented the fact that they've got this cadre of people who've been around a long time that understand where the skeletons lie and what the major decisions are, and these people are retiring or moving on. Some of the younger companies, not quite as young, but certainly eBay, but go on to Google, they don't face it so much, but as there is churn in those companies and, you know, people stock vest and they move on, then that IP is lost as well. There are a number of interesting problems to solve here, and they're on the cusp of both technical as well as social. On the social side, it's one of just finding where those bits of information lie. And that leads me in my handbook work to actually track down the architects of these things so that I can sit at table with them and discuss with them the design decisions that have guided what they're doing. It's also the case that there are some things one can discern on the technical side from an existing system. There's some research efforts that I'm working on inside Watson now, and there have been others before me, that have looked at what can we do automatically to discern some of the information that lives within the code itself. Again, recognizing that it's not the whole truth, but a lot of that truth may be buried. So there's some interesting efforts on just not dynamic and static analysis, which is sort of the classical stuff, but there are people like Jason Smith who are doing work on the identification of patterns from existing systems, things that transcend individual lines of code. You've got to sort of step back and sweep across them and find them. And in many cases, those patterns may have been intentional, but in other cases, those patterns just happen because of the practice of that organization. Although patterns are perhaps the most important development, I think, in software engineering in the last 10 years, it's still the case that their practice has been spotty. And while people may apply patterns in principle, they may not necessarily speak the language of patterns, and that's why discerning these patterns, which just sort of happened, is an important activity.
Archaeology is sometimes as much about the person writing the history as it is about what they're exploring. How do you get people to understand what's being said to them?
That's a great question, and that's one of the open problems. Just being able to discover that those patterns exist and naming them is the first step. Having the folks that manage the system in its most important design decisions recognize the impact of them, that's another step. This is why it's both a technical as well as a sociological issue.
So this is how you learn about the project you're working in. How do you get people to learn from outside of their tribe?
Yeah, great question. And that's also a sociological problem, part of which I think the problem is simply the fact that many people within a given domain don't get out much. I have the incredible privilege of being able to work with organizations that transcend most normal domains that IBM has. So I'm working in the spacecraft community. I've got a really interesting satellite project I'm on right now for which IBM will have no interest in making no money, but there's a lot to be discerned from the architectural side of things. I've been doing work in classical enterprise things, but also, you know, you name it, it's been there. What I discover is that most of the architects that grow up in that space sort of grew up in that area and never went outside that domain. So there's a tremendous amount of apprenticeship that goes on, but there are many times where I've woken up and said, gosh, you know, have you guys considered FUBAR, which I saw at this one gaming company, or have you considered this, which I saw in this, you know, deep space probe? And they look at me like I'm an alien because they don't have time to look at these things. Well, this is one of the purposes of the Handbook of Software Architecture, which is to try to codify architectures of systems as built so that people can at least see that those things exist out there. If you're an engineer or an architect in the civil engineering space, building buildings of various types, you learn by studying the works of the masters. And there are innumerable books in courses that one would take where you'll study Vitruvius and Frank Lloyd Wright and later day ones such as Frank Gehry and the like. So we learn by studying the masters, but in software systems, we don't do that. For a while, I was always asking the academic folks I would speak to, how many of you have classes in code reading? And one or two people might say yes, but even in that level of how we train people, we don't train people to look at and learn from the artifacts of other people. So the handbook is an effort simply to document the as-built of existing systems. And in that process, I'm learning a lot about how one does archaeology. But in the end, I hope that I'll have a representative set of different kinds of architectures that one can learn from.
You've also been looking at preserving software history.
Right. About 7 years ago, I approached the Computer History Museum in the Bay Area and said, hey, you guys are cool, but trustees, you need to turn this into a museum of software as well, because the hardware you're collecting is going to get less and less interesting because it's tiny and you know, you can't look at the big boxes anymore. And so you need to be a museum of software as well. Well, this created this working group, which eventually morphed itself into the creation of a software collections committee. Al Costco is now the software curator, and the museum is actively collecting software. It would be a travesty if future generations did not have the artifacts that we, as our generation and the generation previous, created, because with these things, we changed the world. It sounds silly, but we think of software source code, especially, as so disposable, but imagine 10, 20, 50, 100 years from now, people would lament not having the original artifacts of things like Windows or Words or Linux. And whereas these things are freely available to us, to lesser degree or not, now we need to preserve them for the future. And so that effort is in place. But now once we have that body of it, then it creates an opportunity for a critical analysis of those things themselves. Can we discern some of the key decisions that were made at various times? Can we make sociological studies that say, you know, different genres of programmers produced this style of code versus another? Can we, as Tim O'Reilly is interested in, can we go back to some of these really older things and realize, wow, there's prior art that makes these current patents really profoundly stupid because they were here 40 years ago? The presence of all that code creates an interesting opportunity of mining that future generations will have the ability to take a look at. There's another final sociological aspect of it, is which is we as an industry have changed the world, and yet the number of software developers, at least in the United States, is declining, and how, especially among women. So what do we do to encourage an understanding of the fun, the beauty, the power of building these kinds of systems. People get attracted to art and architecture because they can see these things and are somehow viscerally moved by it. I can't exactly show you a bit of code and say, wow, that really changes how I feel about the world. And yet if we have ways to visualize them, specify them, describe them, and show their inner beauty, I think then we've gone a long way to show some of the power of what we as a community have done. So here we've gone from very pragmatic things to ultimately beauty, and I think there is beauty to be discerned in mind in these things.
With some systems, a lot of the logic lives outside of the source code. How do you preserve and mine that?
I think there are some things we can do with tools, and that's part of the research effort I'm doing at the Watson Labs. There are some things we have to do sociologically. I'm a real fan of Studs Terkel. He wrote some wonderful books. Working is one of them, and he wrote this classic one in which he interviewed veterans of World War II, and there's a lot to be discerned from oral histories. So this is why I think it's such a fascinating opportunity for people who have both a technical as well as a sociological bent, because you often really can't get insight in just from looking at the code itself. You can't understand the rationale. Why is this constant, this number, versus some other? There's no documentation for it. But talking to the people who did it, you can get some of that information. The museum has a pretty extensive oral history program. In fact, the most recent history I did was 2 weeks ago. I went up and interviewed Linus Torvalds for about half a day. And I've done Fred Brooks and John Backus, and he died 2 months later. So, you know, time is not on our side here.
It's great that you're helping capture this oral history. Maybe you can take us back through some of your own history that led to you getting started and getting involved with object-oriented design.
Sure. Well, you know, my history comes from a very different place and in the commercial world, because my early history was in the defense sector. I mean, my first job was at Vandenberg Air Force Base as a project engineer and then a project manager for some telemetry systems. So here I was, 20-something, dealing with a globally distributed system. It was hard real-time, and it dealt with massive amounts of data. So it was a cool place to be, because the government, especially the military, had some really wickedly hard problems to solve. And it was around this time that the whole Ada programming language was popping up. Larry Druffel, one of my former instructors at the Air Force Academy, you know, gave me a call and said, hey, I know you're looking for a new assignment. Would you be interested in getting involved with this? At the same time, I reconnected with Mike Devlin and Paul Levy, who were up at the satellite control facility just up the road from me, and realized, wow, this is an interesting space, and it's a challenging space, because here you've got a community that is building some wickedly complex software systems, and the existing languages we have simply are inadequate for us. I was using Fortran primarily on the real-time distributed stuff I was doing, and even then there were all sorts of practices around it to make it look more structured. And I know that one of the areas where they had the biggest problem in was there was this huge global data pool on which everything poked, and that was the source of most of the consternation. Well, then I began reading about Simula and then Smalltalk hit the road, and then Bjarne Struestrup and I connected, and he was working on a thing called C with classes. It wasn't even C++ yet. And it became very clear to me there was a sea change going on in the way we express things. My reading, you know, in various places took me back to some of the great objectivists, Ayn Rand for one, and some of the work in Plato and Aristotle, who had some classic dialogues on this. The work of Herbert Simon and his ideas of complexity. And that kind of all gelled as I was thinking about the problem Larry left for me, which was, can you help us figure out how to best use this new programming language, Ada, in a software engineering context? And having, you know, been exposed to the structured analysis stuff, I realized we need something fundamentally different. And it kind of gelled from that. So it was that impetus to apply to a new language these ideas that were just emerging that led me to the object-oriented design stuff. Okay. And then that naturally led to the whole representation things, because, you know, these are kinds of structures you can't discern just by looking at the code itself.
It's very important for you to not just stay within the world of computers and to look outside into philosophy and literature and architecture.
Yeah, I think that's true. I'm a voracious reader, just in my nature. One of the reasons my wife and I built our most recent house is we literally ran out of room for books. And by my count, we have close to 10,000 books in our personal library, and I've got close to 3,000 books in my professional library, and I read all of these, so it's not as like I buy these things. I realized that software development is ultimately a human experience, that what we have done and created is very, very technical indeed, but it's full of drama. Some of the stories that I hear in terms of why things are the way they are have nothing to do with the technology, but everything to do with the human foibles therein. And it's also the case, like you were mentioning earlier, gosh, you know, we've done this before, and we have done this before. The kinds of system engineering and pure engineering disciplines that we apply in software have been applied in other disciplines in centuries past, and we just simply aren't aware of them. We as an industry tend to not be very self-aware of our own past, and that is easy to understand because we don't have much of a past. As that past grows, that I think it becomes a more fruitful area of understanding because the past shapes what we do. Part of what I've done with the handbook is not just, you know, capturing the systems as built, which again has a number of interesting problems with it, but also capturing the history of it, because I have this hypothesis, two hypotheses, one of which is that this comes from a book called Systemantics. All successful complex systems are built upon simpler complex systems that worked in the first place, and it's interesting to see that lineage and to see where the breakage is. It's also the case that every one of the systems within a particular domain seems to move to a point of convergence. Talk about cross interplay here. Some of the interesting ideas in theoretical biology these days is the notion that evolution really works for many reasons, one of which is that it tends to lead toward convergence of various kinds of structures. I have this hint that there's the same thing that's true with software systems as well, that we have this very Darwinian approach to our software systems, but ultimately, given a particular domain and the constraints upon it, it does tend to converge to a particular kind of architecture. I'd like to be able to name what those architectures are. Mary Shaw and David Garland have made a stab at it in their classic book on software architecture, but I think there are a few others. But I can't really know what those are until I've looked at a large body of them, and I'll go by induction and say, hey, I've seen these things and they cluster, and therefore I think these are the patterns. And that's more sociological than anything.
If you're advising a junior colleague, what would you advise them to think about, to read, to do?
Great question. The first advice I offer them is have fun. That's one thing that I don't think I enjoyed enough in this process. Be aware that what you're doing is really a blast. It may be tedious, you may be buffeted about by some of the crappy politics going around you, but ultimately you're in a place in an industry that's a pretty exciting place to be. And the second recommendation is read a lot outside your domain. Don't just get wrapped up in your particular space, but intentionally look at what people are doing in places far distant from you. Go on Slashdot and find some thread that interests you in a particularly different place and go pursue it. Look in robotics or computer gaming, you name it, so that at least you get outside of your space. And the third is don't be afraid to fail. Especially as a junior person, you tend to be very, very afraid of failure. But ultimately, if you are always afraid of failing, you will never do any great things. You'll always make timid decisions. So I urge people to not be afraid to fail.
Before we wrap up, can I ask you to talk a bit about Oopsla?
I'm just delighted that Oopsla existed. I have to commend the people that began Oopsla because it really has been over the years a premier forum for this sea change in software engineering. I mean, in Oopsla, look at all the great things that have been embroiled in it, not just the object-oriented analysis and design methods, but all the work around languages in that space. Pattern certainly came out of that community. I mean, Oopsla really represents the premier forum for this current generation of software engineering technology. Even the Agile stuff came out, you know, through an Oopsla connection. So its place in that history is profound. The challenge for Oopsla is how does it continue to transform itself? You know, the software space is becoming a curious one right now, and it's not just because of technical reasons, but also economic reasons. The economic reasons are that worldwide you've got a bit of a malaise, and so you see people entrenching and not having the dollars to spend and innovate, and yet innovation is still required. You also see a bit of a plateau to some degree in the sense that now we have these web-centric systems, which creates this really rich primordial soup upon which we can build some very cool things. And from that, we've seen the rise of scripting languages, Perl, PHP, Ruby, you name it, from which one can build lots of very interesting things. And yet, I'm always reminded of the rise of the 4GLs about a decade or so ago, where similar planets were aligning at the same time, leading us to that. And one wonders, how durable are the things we build here? Because you see many cases where people have built wonderful things with these scripting languages and no one can understand them after a while. So they either have to be blown up or transformed. So it'll be interesting to see in the coming decade how that changes itself, because I think very few of those scripting languages will persist. A few of them will, most of them will not. And we have, in many ways, an obligation to that generation of people who are working in that space, who are primarily programming algorithmically, but in a sea of objects. They use objects, but they don't create many objects. And so they're building upon the abundant fruits that the Uppsala community has built. And it won't always be that way as we keep growing to the next level of abstraction and complexity. How do we speak to that community is a question.
That's Grady Booch, Chief Scientist for Software Engineering at IBM Research and an IBM Fellow. Thank you for listening to the Uppsala podcast. If you want to know more about the conference or would like to listen to additional podcast episodes, visit the Uppsala website at uppsala.org. This episode is released under a Creative Commons license.